Thanks for attending today. It's hard to be in two places at once. And today's session is clearly on retail advertising, its current state and practice future as well. And to help us with this panel session, we've got four people who know a lot about it. Adam Joseph, the Marketing Insights Manager from the Herald Sun. Welcome, good to see you here, thank you. John Bird, CEO of the Leading Edge Group.
Not that I know of, mate. IdeaWorks.
Haven't told you. Beg your pardon. Yeah. That's what you get for writing notes at 4 a.m. You know?
Yeah, unless I got the bullet already.
Angela Ferruglio, Director of Business Planning from Mindshare. And last but not least, we have a futurist. Sounds intriguing, doesn't it?
Go on, stumble over it.
I'm getting there. Morris Malowski.
Mizalowski,
thank you.
That's the way we will.
So listen, we've got about 25, 30 minutes or so. We'll cut a little into lunchtime, I'm sure. We've got a fairly generous lunchtime allocation anyway. And how I want to really structure the session is maybe just throw some questions to the panel and get their view on, you know, what is an interesting, dynamic and evolving discipline in particular. So maybe I thought just start by getting a couple of comments perhaps from each panel member in terms of retail advertising as we are now in 2009. We're all aware of changes either as consumers or practitioners, but I thought from the expert perspective, you know, maybe start with Adam there. What are the key changes which you think are now defining or redefining the industry?
Sure. Well, I think as Bill Clinton once said, it's an economy stupid. I think the economic pressures have really had an impact on everybody across all different sectors, and particularly retail. I think as the global financial economy, the GFC economy has tightened, I think retailers have had to compete harder for customers and compete harder to get people into stores and then to spend the money once they're in there. So I think it's intensified competition. Against that, it has not been a good time to slash marketing budgets. I think now more than ever, it's been important to keep marketing, keep the brand messages out there, and to keep reminding people that you're there, your value proposition, and to come in and spend loads of money.
Hear, hear.
Angela, what changes do you think now to define the landscape?
As a consumer, for the consumer, the sales have appeared more genuine, and greater discount percentages, so you might get up, you got up to around 70-80, and because they were so much bigger than what you traditionally saw, consumers are actually virally talking about that, so they pass on those discounts, either talking to their friends, texting them, emailing, and telling you, hey, there's 70% off here, there's 80% off here. So I've found that there's a lot more viral word of mouth going on this year because the sales have been so strong. And across multiple brands. I mean, you never ever heard of Bulgari discounting, but they had a sale about 3-4 weeks ago now, which is just unheard of in our lifetime.
Okay, thanks. John?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're in the middle of a perfect storm, really. I mean, from an economic point of view, we have been, but also I think from a media point of view generally. I mean, we've had continuing media fragmentation, you know, over-communication, changing media habits, a more sophisticated consumer, the rise of digital, all kind of happening at the one time, which I think, you know, which has made it confusing and challenging for advertisers, but also I think very, very exciting. And I think, you know, the primary challenge going forward is how best to connect one-on-one with customers and engage in dialogue with them. I think that's where it's going.
Because that presents a difficulty in itself. How do you communicate to mass consumers in an individual way? I mean, that's it. Kind of seems a contradiction in terms. We want personalisation, but you have to use major stream messaging. Will that ever be resolved?
Well, I think you do two different things, really. I mean, you can build a brand broadly on a mass level, and I think people will still keep doing that, but then you can communicate individually to consumers in discrete segments with appropriate messages to get them to get them to respond. So I think they can cohabit quite easily.
And on that point, do you think that retailers here are smart enough when it comes to matters of segmentation? Do they think they know enough about the subcultures within the consumer base, the different kinds of people who present to them?
Look, I think they're definitely getting there, and they're getting more and more sophisticated all the time. You know, arguably we're a long way behind our cousins in the United States or the UK, But, you know, I work with retailers on a daily basis who have perhaps a set of 16 customer segments broadly, and then one core customer who they communicate with on a mass level, if you like, and then individually to those different customer segments.
Okay, thanks. Morris, you're a futurist.
I am.
You know, looking forward into the industry or to the future of the industry, you know, what do you think that advertisers will have to pick up on in order to be as successful and as relevant?
Look, we are on the cusp of an evolution. The world has changed as far as we know it, and we will not go back to what we were before. Traditional advertising spends are down, and I don't think they're going to bounce back in the traditional sense that we've seen them. We're going to spend a lot of that money online in different media than we have before. The notion of demographics is also an issue for me. I mean, I taught marketing for 15 years right through to postgraduate. I get demographics, I get technographics, which is the online version of it. I just think it's going to become more and more problematic as we move forward over the next 5 or 10 years to segment a marketplace. Because what I'm finding now is that a consumer is one thing in the morning, lunchtime he or she is something else, and by the evening they are something else. In other words, in the morning they're looking for a huge discount, in the afternoon they're looking for a quality product, and then at night they're looking to go out on the social. So they want different information. We're going to have to learn to work across all of those spheres, and I think it's totally possible. There are technologies around now that will allow us to do it. There are ways to communicate, but we're going to have to learn to send that message out on a one-to-one basis, which is primarily where we're headed down the track, and we're going to have to become very sophisticated at that. That's not to say that the overall brand is not going to disappear, because it won't, and you're right, we'll have to do the overall marketing behind that. But if we want people to come into our store, if we want people to engage with us, to have conversations with us, to feel that we are part of their community or they're part of our community, and that's the buzzword, we're going to have to engage them one-on-one. We're going to have to go out and stare at them in the eyeballs and give them the information they want, when they want it, where they want it, how they want it. And none of that is necessarily difficult or complex. It's just a different way of going about things.
I was going to ask again about some of the complexity in terms of multi-channel. I mean, with, you know, in the good old days, I guess, you'd put an advert in the paper, people would come, people would buy stuff, and then you'd know if the medium had worked and you'd know if the message had worked. But we're here, and we'll hear more over the next couple of days, about not just online marketing, not just embedded messaging in online. We'll hear about Twitter, we'll hear about Tweet, we'll hear about Facebook. I was reading just a couple of days ago, you know, the first fully Facebook located store was launched to the public. And I guess you've got that evolution on the one hand. You've also got retailers looking to advertisers to bring them the next big thing. Do you think that the advertising industry is actually following fads, or is it in itself creating trends? I mean, how much of what you can do should actually be done, put it that way, and how much responsibility do advertisers have to ask some of those hard questions? Yes, you can Twitter, but why should you? Or you can Facebook, but why would you? Well, what are your thoughts on that, Ali?
Well, I think it's just because you can doesn't mean you should. Yeah. I think you have to look at social media as another channel. It's marketing rules apply, marketing common sense apply. So if you go into, if you look at social media and you say, how can this help my business? Perhaps you might use it as a channel for insight and for listening. For others, it might be a channel for customer service and interaction. For others, it could be a sales channel. For others, it could be a viral channel, as we saw with JCPenney for the Doghouse campaign. I think the key is just to have brand positioning is at the start. So be true to your brand. What does your brand tell you to do? If your brand tells you to have a Facebook page, listen to your brand. If your brand says it's not right, it doesn't fit with your positioning, think long and hard about whether it's the right choice. And also, I think it's very important to have marketing metrics on your mind as well, and to think, okay, you're going into the social media world, for example, whether it's on Twitter or another platform, what exactly are you trying to get out of it, and what are your metrics? Are you trying to get a certain number of followers, because that's a pretty meaningless metric, or are you trying to help 2,000 customers find the products they're looking for? So it's just about how you define what you're trying to get out from each channel and making sure those are good marketing metrics up front and not the meaningful things like number of friends, number of followers or number of tweets or meaningless stuff like that.
Amplifying what Adam said, I think there's a real danger, as you said, rushing into social media in particular without a plan in the first place, without knowing why you actually want to do it. And secondly, not resourcing it in the right way. I mean, there are all kinds of Twitter pages and Facebook pages up there which are launched with a rush of enthusiasm and then left there to kind of falter. You know, you need to make sure that you've got people who are resourced to to communicate in the right way via those channels. And as I said in the first place, as you said, Adam, you need a plan.
Yeah. And Angela, you're with a leading creative media agency. I mean, you know, you must have a finger on the pulse.
What, a media agency?
You know, what from your...
I would give my clients a couple of pieces of advice. No matter what category you're in, always test, learn, evolve a new channel. So you might allocate 5 or 10% of your budget towards trialing new things and measure that. And if you can't measure that and the success of that, you certainly wouldn't put any more money into it or continuing on with that investment of that existing 5%. And you have to have measurable metrics and not just, 10,000 people signed up. Now, whether it's Twitter or Facebook, to Adam's point, I think for retail brands, you probably might look at your ambassadors. So particularly in the fashion area of Myer and David Jones, you'd look at their fashion ambassadors more than you'd look at the brand.
Yep.
What young person is going to follow a brand like that? But they might follow Jennifer Hawkins and what she's wearing and what she's attending versus things like that. But again, if you don't have the manpower internally to keep that going and keep it fresh on a daily basis, there's no point in investing in that in the first place. I think one of the huge opportunities today, and it's not really sexy, is all the CRM, all the loyalty programs out there, and understanding the customers of them and talking to them one-on-one. It's the cheapest thing as a retailer that you could do. It's not sexy. It doesn't make front page of the news because you're not the first on Facebook with this campaign. But you can certainly measure how many sales are from those customers. And the first that probably did that successfully that I'm aware of is Peter Alexander, because he didn't have a store first. He actually had his catalogue business and his online business first. So he knew absolutely who his customers were, could segment them before he even got to who walks in off the street. And he can tell you the value of his customers and he segments them in a very simplistic way, but to great success, and talk to them as a one-on-one.
And another one who's done that very well, I think, is Maya.
They've got 3 million in their CRM. I mean,
with their Myer One program, I mean,
it's huge.
Bernie said last year that it was Bernie Brooks, who's the head of Myer, as part of it. It was part of a strategy to improve engagement with customers, and they've moved a lot of their above the line spend into CRM.
Absolutely. I mean, but it isn't sexy.
No, but it works.
It is. I mean, it's a fundamental point of engagement which many businesses gloss over. I mean, we still talk now about businesses who are, you know, pursuing some of the more obscure methods of communication, but still don't have that basic depth of understanding.
But I mean, I ask you, with 3 million customers in your CRM database for Maya, have they cut one catalogue of their 48 catalogues a year? So how really are they trialling this?
Well,
you know, can they get off the catalogue drug?
I think that's a great point. We're going to come to return on investment a little way down the line, because I think you're right. I mean, the more choice you have doesn't mean you have to do everything to the same degree you used to. Morris, I mean, again, looking forward, there's a lot of things you can do, and a lot of pathways that an agency might recommend to a client. Which ones do you think we're looking at now which will have long-term traction, and which ones will turn out to be, you know, the Betamax of meter, if you like,
sure,
ones that people will move away from?
I concur with the thought. I mean, when I talk to my clients, it's always about the strategy and never about the tools. My analogy is you need to be able to build the house. You know, whether you use a hammer or a nail gun is really immaterial. So it's a matter of understanding what you want to achieve, who the consumer is. And there's a fundamental shift for me moving forward, and that is that the consumer has truly become the centre point. We always made the platitude about that. I always thought that, you know, the consumer was king. But the reality is now that 60% of all retail decisions have a life online, meaning we might not buy it online, but we'll research it online, we'll talk to a friend about it, we'll go and find the price comparison, we'll find out where else it's available. We need to understand that consumers want to be engaged where and when they want to be. And to me, that's one of the biggest tools moving forward. Whether it's a Twitter, whether it's a Facebook, whether it's anything else, to me really doesn't matter. I can tell you, I almost guarantee Twitter is not what it will be in 3 years from now. Twitter is very embryonic. It was a mistake. It's one of those things that evolved. It is an immature product. That's not to say it's not a successful product, but it's immature, and the founders will say the same thing. It will eventually rival Google, and it will become the search engine of the future. because people are now searching through other people's comments and ideas to find their own ideas and to be informed about what the public wants. Dell, for instance, is doing really well on Twitter at the moment. They've sold $3 million in the last year. They have a Dell outlet store, which puts up the last minute items. So they look around the factory anywhere in the world and they say, we have 3 CPUs left over, a screen left over, let's put it online at a price, and first come, first serve. So we're beginning to engage with our customers in that. And I agree, absolutely, this is not a baby in bathwater. You should not do one to the neglect of the other. But we need to understand that the virtual world and the real world coexist now. But you need to be congruent on both. You need to be the same on both. And to me, being in the virtual world is not about having a fancy website or a shopping cart. It's far more than that. It's really being true to who you are, that people that find you online can come into the store and have the same experience, and that this online world that you're offering has the information, has the access, has the ability to engage your customers and bring them in the store. A piece of research only in the last 3 weeks shows the most successful retailers in the States, online retailers in the States, are successful because what they're doing is not selling online. They're actually allowing people to engage online, to buy it online, but then to come into store to pick it up, and their on-purchases are in fact far more successful than their online sales. But it's driving them into the store because they're actually going in to pick up a pair of shoes. So I think they're the things we need to look at. This is all frontier stuff. It's all new. There's a lot of stuff we can develop. There's a lot of stuff we can innovate.
Picking up on Morris's point that, you know, a lot of the more advanced retailers around the world are talking about cross-channel now rather than multi-channel. Mm-hmm. And that's referencing, you know, each channel to market to another one. So selling from the store to online, selling from online into catalogue, selling from catalogue to another channel. And
so there's some continuum in how you actually commit to that business and the options and the doors.
Yeah, and you leave it up to the customer as to how he or she wants to deal with the retailer.
At the time and the place that's relevant to them.
Absolutely.
Well, let's talk for a minute about something which has just been mentioned, the, you know, not so much the mechanism but the message and the strategy. Now for a long time, I think, and you know, if you think back to just the major campaigns of recent times, there's been a big emphasis in retail on the price driven promotion. I mean, that's what has driven people to the stores, that's what's got them through the doors, that's what's really, you know, defined in a lot of ways the key message of a business. But then we hear again, you know, from some of the sessions today in the main auditorium, conspicuous consumerism, taking the downturn, less fashionable, more considered consumers. Do you think Australian retail is going to have a tough time moving away from such a strong focus on price messaging? And what are the other advertising and marketing messages which you think will have increasing traction going forward and hopefully as we come out of what's been a recessionary time? What are consumers going to want to hear retailers talking about?
Well, I think that there are a number of P's in the marketing mix. You know, starting out with 4, then you get 3 extra 3. Price has not had its day. Of course it hasn't had its day. It's going to continue to be a very, very important message because it's an integral part of the value equation with consumers. So has price advertising had its day? No way. We're going to see a lot more price advertising in the future from most retailers. But there are other messages. There are other things in addition to price. There's product. For example, in fashion apparel, there's new season ranges. Place, distribution, that old chestnut in the marketing mix. If you're building your web presence, you're building e-commerce, or you've got a brand website that you want to drive people to, it's another platform, so you could promote that potentially in your advertising. People, I don't know whether you're fans of the Good Guys TV ads, but there's a lot of happy people jumping around, and you get the feeling that if you went into one of their stores, you'd be served by a lot of happy people who've got some pretty good moves. So I think there are always going to be a multiplicity of messages out there, but price is always going to be key. And it goes back to the consumer because price matters to them. And it's an integral part of that value equation that doesn't just have price, but has price, I think, at the centre.
I'm actually not so convinced price is an argument moving forward for the next 10 years or so. I think it is at the moment. But I think price is one of those things that will be taken for granted soon, meaning that I can already, with my PDA, with my phone, into any retail store, by zapping a barcode, I can get around me in the proximity. So I zap my barcode, I tell it how far I'm willing to travel, a kilometre, 5 kilometres, and it will find all of the stores in that radius that are carrying that item, and it will give me the pricing for that item, the availability, it'll tell me whatever I want, and I can also purchase it online. So I think increasingly the price issue is going to be something consumers will find for themselves. I think we'll still advertise that point.
I think that's nice if you buy a television. But if you're a mum with three kids trying to buy a family meal, it's, you want a guarantee. You know, you want to know you're not getting ripped off. So Bunnings have done very well with their guaranteed 10%, you know, we'll beat it. And they're not always the cheapest for every single item, but you walk in there with a sense of confidence that you're not getting ripped off.
But if I was...
And you look at what Coles have done in the last month, they are starting to shift from, you know, here's sausages for $3.99 a kilo to here's a meal for under $10. And mum can look at that and say, oh, that's good, because it is tough at the moment. I don't want to spend too much money, but sausages at $3.99 is not helping me with my end goal. A meal under $10, I go, that's $70 a week. And I find I'm not getting ripped off. I can deal with that. I'm not going to then go and use my PDA to shop around and travel all this way to get the lowest prices.
I think that's right, though. I mean, what you're saying is price is single-dimensional on its own.
Yeah.
It's, customers don't buy prices. Customers buy solutions and they buy packages. And I believe,
I believe
absolutely it's moving to value, and value has been the big story in retail over the last 2 years, and ongoing it'll be the big story too. And
that's, well, let's just ask about timing on that point as well, because it seems almost coincidental that almost the same week we hear about the green shoots of recovery, Coles are now pressing the price or the value messaging, feed a family for $10 or less.
Yeah, but they're not pushing that message in isolation. There are other messages. So that's one campaign of a number that they'll be working on.
So should they have started that 6 months ago?
Oh, probably, but they didn't have their act together at that time.
I would say, culturally, it was facilitated by the sponsorship of MasterChef. And they came into the fold at the very end. It wasn't a considered sponsorship from a media standpoint. They were the last ones in, which is why all their in programs were in the last five episodes. And I don't work on the brand, but I would say that they got together and said, oh, shit, how are we going to make this work? Because we're buying Herbies and we're buying all the best ingredients that there are that aren't sold in Coles, and Coles are going, well, I don't know, make a meal for under $10.
Well, it's pinched from Sainsbury's in the UK. Yeah, feed probably. A family
and
for
they
under
went, Fiver. Oh, this, we can make this work. I mean, but Coles have been treading this water a little bit. This isn't the first time. Like, with the Olympics last year, you saw their campaign, and it was all about how mums get up early and dads get up early and they take their kids to the swimming, and it's all about buying quality ingredients in the store to feed their families. There wasn't a price promotion for the first 8 days of the Olympics, which is unheard of for Coles.
Yeah, I don't think they knew what they were doing, though, either. genuinely
don't. It was more good luck than good management, but the Ipsos tracking of all the Olympic ads, it was, if not the most successful from my memory, the second most successful ad of all sponsors.
Winning through weight, perhaps.
No, because they're a sponsor level, so they bought the same weight of everyone else.
Let's have a think for a minute about... We'll just pick up a couple more key questions here. But advertising and return on investment, I mean, I was doing some research recently in terms of the history of advertising, and one of the quotes which jumped off the page at me was that advertising was the last bastion of uncontrolled spending within organisations. So, you know, as we move into new mediums and as the relationship between mediums becomes more complex, so it's not just newspaper store purchase, it's now web, newspaper, catalogue, store, in-store marketing, celebrity endorsement, purchase. What are the lessons for evaluators of advertising effectiveness, and what are some of the new or perhaps the more important measures of how well that works? John?
It's true. The argument has always been that it's hard to isolate the effect of your advertising, that whole thing of, you know, I don't know which half of my advertising is being wasted. I do think that, you know, with some of the new media and with discrete messages to discrete customers, you're going to be able to very clearly see a return on investment. But I still think that there's going to be as much art as science about communication moving forward. You're going to need to look at a whole range of different metrics and use, you know, to some extent, instinct as part of the measurement. You know, great retailers analyse sales, they analyse foot traffic, they analyse brand awareness, they analyse perception, and then take all those measures and apply them to different campaigns that they're running.
Okay. Is it difficult to encourage retailers to measure more?
No, absolutely not.
More stringently?
No. Great retailers, measure themselves every single day.
Any thoughts on the new school of measurement or the refresh school?
I think they measure themselves every day on a holistic level, but not in terms of which communication channels are working the most effectively to drive incremental sales above their baseline. I'm not sure there's many smarter retailers in this market that adopt market mix modelling, yet the FMCG brands and the like have been doing it for 15, 20 years. So they know what works and what doesn't, down to every, in increments of $10,000. If you said to a retailer what percentage is driven by catalogues, what percentage is driven by television,
yep,
and the like, they would probably give you some numbers, but I'm not sure they're empirically, statistically sound, because they wouldn't know, which is why I say they're on the catalogue drug and they don't know how to get off it, because they haven't done the data to say, oh, I shouldn't be doing 48 catalogues, I should be doing 52, or if I cut it down to 30 and spend that same amount of money on radio, on newspapers, and online, it would drive my business by 30%, or if I cut that money altogether and save 20%, I'm still delivering the same sales. They probably couldn't tell you that.
So you think the advertising costs are therefore blowing up, it's people doing something of everything rather than focusing on a disciplined basket?
The budgets don't go up year on year, but costs go up year on year. So something's giving. So whether they drop the amount of television weight, whether they drop the production quality of things or reduce the number of pages in a catalogue, or just drop channels out altogether, if something has to give.
I think that's a really good point. I think my understanding of retailers is they're actually quite sophisticated at measuring what works and what doesn't, and can track sales, SKUs day by day, store by store. I think the emphasis now is falling more on media owners like the Herald Sun. Display advertising, and retail is our biggest display advertising category, and we have literally hundreds of retailers who we call our clients. And the emphasis is falling back on us to demonstrate not whether something works or not, but how it works. We've been using a big online reader panel that I manage to do that, and to actually work with select retailers and say, you know that your sales go up when you place the ads with us, but this is how they work. So this is the awareness you get, this is the ad recognition, these are the amount of people who are interested in the product, these are the people who claim to do something as a result, whether it's talking about something, visiting a website or going in store. And I think when you throw metrics like that into the mix, it just helps understanding how something works, and you do get a sense that a particular medium is working for you, and you can understand how it's coming around. So I think the media owners need to do more. We'll put our money where our mouth is and we'll start, but I think it goes across the board, across all media channels. I think catalogs are particularly good at in terms of effectiveness and tracking. So I guess I'm just speaking about the traditional above the line media.
Let's just focus on a couple more questions, and then we'll go on our way to lunch. I'll be pleased to know as well. But before then, there's just two more things I wanted to ask about. Maybe just get a comment from each of you in relation to each of the questions. And the first question is about how effectively is marketing and advertising executed in store. We hear a lot about influence people to get to store, but downstairs we've got an exhibition hall full of new technologies in terms of touch screens, interactive displays, sensory stimulation, lighting, fixtures, fitting, point of purchase influence. What do you think the future for the evolution in that realm will hold? Is there still value in the last 3 yards? Morris?
I think there's absolute value in the last 3 yards. I think we're going to get down to the last millimetre. If you come downstairs and have a look at the store of 2020, you'll see some of the attempts that are being made, again using technology, but that's the tool to really engage with people at that coal face, that when they're coming up to a bottle of water, for instance, they want more information about it. Using technology they have at hand to be able to engage with that product, to get an advertising message, to get the nutrients of it, to find out its origin if they're concerned about where it came from, to find out about the calorific element of it, to work with the promotion, and also to go out to their Facebooks and their communities and ask them whether they're engaged with that product. We're going to find increasingly that consumers are engaging with the product at the shelf. So it really is going to be down to that last millimetre now. And that's a new frontier for advertising and for promotion.
John, your views on that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, in-store is critical because there's research to say that up to 75% of purchase decisions are made in store. And I agree absolutely with Morris, and a lot of it's going to come down to communicating with consumers via this device in store. I was reading there's a system in the US called Aislecaster, which can narrowcast a promotional offer to a customer within a 1 metre range. So that's really interesting. Another thing that I saw in Japan recently on the Westfield World Retail Study Tour was a system in a Japanese supermarket in the fresh area, where they had QR codes on the fresh items that you could scan, and it instantly tells you where the product came from, how long it's been since it was in the ground to the store, all that kind of stuff, which resulted in increases in sales on those particular items by 30%. So I think there are all sorts of really interesting things that are going to happen in an in-store environment. And to me, it's a part of where we're going, which is direct communication with customers.
Even at last.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Angela and Adam, are you influenced in store by what's in front of you, or do you have a mindset which says, I've got my list, I'm going in and buying it, regardless of what
I'm going to be really old school here and say, I think it's about people, not technology, or it's about people first. We talked about one-on-one communication. Well, you get that every chance, every time you come into contact with a sales associate or a sales rep or salesperson, you have that chance of that interaction. It's almost a change of terminology. Instead of sales, salespeople or associates, what about brand ambassadors? Have any retailers gone out there and said, our staff are now brand ambassadors, and just widened the remit for these people, because they are the people delivering the service on the front line. They are your in-store marketers, I guess. So I just see a different way of looking at the sales forces or sales reps, or however you ought to call them. A piece of research has crossed my desk very recently by the Realize Group, and they do mystery shopping, as I'm sure many of you are familiar. Their research basically said that only 48% of the sales assistants they researched attempted to add on or upsell a purchase, which is 4% down on 2007. So less than half, and it's declining. These people are brand ambassadors in store. They can have such a big effect on the in-store marketing. So I look at the people, not the technology.
I was actually in a fashion store the other day, and there was three members of staff in the store, and they were stood around the desk. And you get the cursory hello when you walk in. Then they started a conversation. And the conversation was to a new member of staff in the store, was to do with, did you know you can be disciplined if you're stood around the desk while there's customers in store? It's very interesting to hear. And did you know that you shouldn't also talk amongst yourselves while there's customers in the store? And I was struck by the irony of that, in that, here we have people talking about the fact they shouldn't be talking to each other around the desk when there's customers in store. So I think that's kind of supported by that very observation, that the point of purchase actually involves people, not just technology.
But I think the technology allows people to get out in front and do what they need to do, which is share the wisdom they have. The reality is, with most of the clients I've got anyway, that with the best of intention, their staff really aren't as knowledgeable always as they need to be about that product. If we can get that mundane information across in a relatively easy way that everybody can access, then our brand ambassadors, and I think that's a great word, our brand ambassadors can really get out in front and share the wisdom and do what they need to do really well.
Angela, list shopper, or are you influenced by what you see in front of you?
Of course we are. In fact, my new fad is looking at the cost per kilogram in supermarkets, because I was recently on maternity leave, so spending less became suddenly a little bit more important. So that's my new fad. But it's interesting, when I worked in Asia, in China, all stores do have brand ambassadors. So when you first walk into a pharmacy or you first walk into a supermarket, it's quite daunting, because you're like, oh my God, there's 100 people that work in this store. But one person may only sell aspirin, one person may only sell another certain drug, and that's what they do, and they stand in their section. And they are paid for by individual brands. They do not receive any income from the store owners themselves. So we may go back to that old-fashioned, what we would think an old-fashioned
partnership,
or we may go forward and just go with technology.
Final question for each of you. Start with Adam. One or two-word response. So as a consumer and as a commentator and as an analyst and as all those things, who's doing a good job in cutting through advertising, marketing, promotion? Who stands out to you?
Two words: Target and Coles.
Target
will be my first choice, just because of the they use segmentation and they use it very cleverly. Their campaigns are I think their advertising is fantastic, it's creative, and I understand it's very effective as well. So, target.
Okay, thanks. Angela, who talks to you all?
Coles is my new one, although I'm not a big supermarket shopper, but I'm liking what they're doing. I like the road, whether it's by accident or planned, I like the road that they're heading, and I hope they keep going in that direction.
Okay, thanks. John?
Bunnings, you know, a hugely well-regarded brand from a consumer point of view because of their consistency. They really stick with their message and they stick with their knitting. The Good Guys, who I think do a great job of brand above the line and then catalogues to get the price and product message out. And McDonald's, I think, mm-hmm. is, you know, to me, probably the best retailer in the country.
Mm. Morris?
Can I go offshore and online? I think Zappos.com is a great example of what an online retailer can be in an offline presence. If you haven't had a look at them, Zappos.com. I think if we're talking about here, I agree with all those, of course. I think Sports Girl, I mean,
yep.
is a great example of a brand that's doing really well. They have a website that went up about 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, that talks about what retail might look like moving forward. I think that's a great example of a local one.
Mm-hmm. And Morris, finally, you're a futurist. Who's got the best campaign for 2010?
any client that works with me.
Listen, thanks for bearing with us, guys. I know we're a few minutes behind schedule, but thank the panel, Angela.